So I think we're going to get started. Thank you all for being here. If anyone wants to come further up, please do. Don't be afraid. We really want this to be an interactive discussion, conversation, talking about work-life integration and strategies for work-life success. My name is Samantha Wall-Ravens. I am a Forbes writer, Huffington Post contributor, and I've written a book. It's actually a couple years old now, so I'm honored to be here. It's called Torn: True Stories of Kids' Career and the Conflict of Modern Motherhood. Lizanne just published a book yesterday. It came out.
Yay!
It's called Work, Pause, Thrive.
It was its birthday.
Its birthday was yesterday. And the bio on Lizanne, she left the advertising world because she was frustrated by the lack of support for mothers in the workplace. She's become an award-winning journalist, and she writes for the New York Times, Fortune, Newsweek, Salon, and other high-profile media outlets. And now she's the CEO and founder of a company called Prism Work, which is a culture innovation consultancy. So I'm excited to introduce you to Work, Pause, Thrive, and to Lizanne Stomberg.
Thanks for being here, guys.
So I just wanted to ask you about the title, Work, Pause, Thrive, and the inspiration for this book, because I love the word pause. It just makes me think of, you know, taking time out. And is there really a possibility of pausing in this crazy 24/7 world that we live in? Why did you choose that word, and what's the inspiration for this book?
Well, Margaritas, my husband, he got the name. Let's start there. Okay. How often do we take that moment to pause, right? Even in our day, we talk about everyone wanting to be meditating and all of that. It is so hard. So I was very intentionally trying to find that time, that way to say, we need to take those moments to pause. What I had discovered in the research, and we can talk a lot about that, but what I discovered in interviewing 186 women and surveying 1,500 more was that we think of women who leave the workforce to care for children as opting out. But what we discovered in the research is that they didn't opt out. In fact, what they had done was pause. And so it was very important that I reframed how we look at these careers and how we looked at all of our careers and look at them as not ending our career if, in fact, we are town-shifting or pausing for caregiving, but, in fact, using that as a pause, and our careers are long, and we look at our careers as long. So it was really chosen word for that reason.
Okay. So let's cut to the chase here. Are we talking about a first-world problem, as my kids say? Like, are we talking about the top 1% of the population? Because let's face it, it's like 60% of households in the U.S. today have both partners working. It's kind of a luxury to be able to pause and take time off. So,
thank you for that great question. So let's debunk a whole bunch of myths here. Who's heard the statistic that 70% of mothers with children under the age of 18 work? Has anyone heard that stat? So that's the stat that goes around, 70%. Turns out it's only 48% of American women with the children under the age of 18 work full time. Let me throw a couple of other stats out there. If you have gone to a top 20 college in the United States, so the Ivy Leagues and the next tier under that, top 20% college, 57% of you will leave the paid workforce for a period of time. So there's another statistic. I can just keep going all day, but I'll just throw out some more. When we look, Pew Research Center says they did a study of stay-at-home moms. Guess how many of those stay-at-home moms are the kind of yummy mummy top 1% that we all think about, that you're talking about? How many would you think is the reality? 5%. The reality is the vast majority of moms who stay home are actually middle class or under-resourced mom who want to work but can't because the workplace doesn't support moms. We don't support people with caregiving responsibilities. So let's completely blow up that fancy notion of pausing as a luxury. The sad truth is with millennials, the vast majority of millennials, who's the best educated millennial right now? Anyone know? A woman. 60% of college degrees right now are for women. Millennial women. They're the best educated people we have out there. And guess what's happening with millennials? The vast majority of those owning school debt, millennial women. Guess what's happening to millennial women? They can't afford, they're not now just having babies. They can't afford childcare and school debt. Guess what happens? They stay home. because you can't give up school debt. So this whole notion that pausing is a privilege is absolutely not true. We have to completely reframe how we think about it and completely reframe how we think about careers and how we dance these careers. And the ones who can do that are we women who are right now in the trenches, because we can make change for the women coming behind us and actually change our employers' perceptions about what this nonlinear career path looks like.
So let's step back a bit, because in the spirit of Viola Davis, let's show our messy selves. So I love the beginning of your book when you talk about being on the airplane 30,000 feet in the air, feeling labor pains, you're going into labor.
Yeah.
You're on your way to a work meeting across the country. Tell me that story.
Sure. Well, let me back up to 13 years old. So listen, I got my first job at 13. I lied and said I was 18 and I worked in an ice cream store. It was awesome. I had my first paycheck. I think it was like $16 or something. I don't know. I worked every day of my life until my son was born. The only time I took off was when I was in college, but I worked almost all through college. I actually took 2 years off to get my MBA, and then I went back and I worked. So, at 32 weeks with my firstborn, my water broke unexpectedly. 32 weeks. I was rushed to the hospital, and I spent the next 2 weeks in the hospital, and they were hoping to prevent labor. He came at 34 weeks. The first weeks of his life were in the ICU, the other babies dying. It was awful. That did not stop me, however, from very quickly, right after my maternity leave ended, of racing back to my career ladder. I was a brand manager at Nestle, and I was not going to let anything get in my way. Now, the good news is my son was well, and he was going to thrive, and I knew that. Flash forward 2 years, I had been promoted. I'd actually left that company, got promoted into Footcone Belding, a national, actually now international advertising agency, one of the largest in the world. I was on the fast track. Things were great. I was pregnant with my second child, 24 weeks along, just landed a big client, going out to meet that client, and I start contracting 24 weeks along. And I know what's happening here. I know I'm going to have this baby. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh. And I'm not much of a prayer. Everyone has their God, and I'm still fighting with mine. I'm sure he or she exists. I'm just trying to convince myself. But I'm telling you, on that plane, I found God, and I prayed. And I said, please, please get me through this. Do not let this baby come early. Let me figure out what I can do for my life to reframe it so that I can actually be there for this child in some way, shape, or form. Plane landed. Took some breaths, literally got on a plane right after that, sorry, I'm client, and went back home and got stuck on bed rest for 4 months. Now, that sucks. It sucks for my employer because they want me to thrive and be productive, and it sucked for me and my family. But what it also did for me was actually really shift what my priorities were. I knew at the end of my days, if I had reached that glass ceiling, if I had actually been CEO as I envisioned myself to be, that it wouldn't be enough, that if I wasn't available to my child to be there in the way that I needed to be, that that was not a life well lived. So I made a decision that I never, ever imagined I would make, and that was that I quit my job and I became an opt-out mom. Truth of the matter is, I wasn't opt-out for very long. I ended up going back to work by consulting. I pivoted. I ended up starting a nonprofit, ran that for 5 years, went back to graduate school, got my MFA. I always loved to write. That was my kind of awareness. Became a journalist. And now I'm actually full circle and working with companies to help them figure out how they cannot lose you, the great talent that they have, and how they cannot lose the next group of women who are rocking it and we don't want to lose. So I'm on a campaign to make sure that this doesn't happen. Meanwhile, that's not going to change fast enough. I don't even want to go into what's happening in Washington right now. Mm-hmm. I had dreams of getting paid leave. We're one of two countries that don't have it, right? Two countries in this world do not offer paid leave. Sorry, westernized countries do not offer paid leave. Papua New Guinea and the U.S. That's not acceptable. Mm-hmm. So long story short, it was that moment where I literally said, I have to change my life for my baby, and now I want to change my life for you, because it shouldn't be this way. We shouldn't have to make these choices. Mm-hmm. That was my story.
Great story. Good choices. So there was a recent study I actually just read about this morning from the American Journal of Public Health showing that even though there's five whopping states in the U.S. that now offer or have laws requiring paid family leave, and this has been over the past 10 years that these states have signed these laws, the number of women taking maternity leave has not budged in 20 years. So even with these laws giving women and parents paternity leave, people aren't taking it. What is going on here? What needs to change that people will actually pause just for those few weeks or a few months after having a baby? What's going on with our mindset in our country?
Well, So heartbreaking, right? Here we actually have the opportunity to take paid leave. If you work for a company, most of you probably, how many of you work for a company that offers paid maternity leave? Most of you, right? Guess what? It turns out most women don't take the full leave that they're offered. They're afraid to take that full leave because they're afraid it's going to punish their careers. It's heartbreaking, actually, because look, I believe those first few months, maybe even arguably first 4 years of those, that child life needs you. Right? They need you. And you need that child. You're going to change. You are never the same after that baby's born. So I'm telling, tell every woman you know to take that full paid leave. And if your employer doesn't actually continue to promote you, and we're going to talk about motherhood bias in a minute, find another job. Because your next employer, one of the women I interviewed, this rock star, Vidya Peterson, she is so awesome. She was at Intel. She took 6 months, the most she could actually take. And her career was rocking, but eventually she said, okay, I want to be at another job. Her next employer has no idea how long her maternity leave is. They have no idea. So she took advantage of what she could do and then moved on. And that's kind of the message I'd like to convey.
Well, let's talk about that. Shelley Carrell, who is a professor, is still a professor at Stanford University in sociology. She wrote back in 2007 a book called The Motherhood, or a paper, or did a paper called The Motherhood Penalty. And basically what she found in her research was that mothers are paid less, are promoted less, are seen as less committed and less competent as their male colleagues, as well as their female colleagues without children. Whereas on the other hand, talking of bias, fathers get what they call a fatherhood bonus. So men in the workplace who have kids, all of a sudden, they're paid more, they're promoted more, they're more committed, they're more competent. I mean, what did you find in your research? Does this play out with what you saw when you did your interviews and surveys?
So, you know, I wrote the book for a lot of different reasons, not the least of which is I was trying to figure out what the heck, why is it so darn hard? And I found out about does everyone ever heard of ideal worker, the ideal worker construct? So in the United States, we have what's called the ideal worker. And let me describe what that person looks like. I bet you know him. He typically can be all in 24/7, answering emails at 2 in the morning. He's traveling all over the world. And if he has a family at home, he has someone at home caring for that family. Right? That's what our workplace is structured around. That's who gets promoted. That's a reinforcing construct. So if we want to go in there, and we women who typically, if we have children, have this other priority happening, we're already behind the eight ball because we can't be ideal workers. We literally cannot be the ideal worker. So we're facing up against that. The second thing we face up against is this thing called the motherhood bias, and it is proven again and again. So that research that she did was fascinating. She had two resumes, exactly the same resumes, exactly the same name, everything the same. The only difference on that resume was that one had PTA participation on it. Otherwise, nothing else different. And in those resumes, what happened is they went out and they asked people, they asked employers and they asked students. So that was the two groups that they studied. Consistent results. Who's going to be more employable? Who's going to be more promotable? Who's going to earn more money? The women who did not have, these were two women, the women who did not have their PTA participation were hired 84% of the time. The women with PTA participation on their names, 47% of the time. So that alone penalized you just to get the job. Then when you get in the job, the employer doesn't think you're as promotable, they don't think you're as committed, etc. But let me debunk all of that. There's now recent longitudinal research about women in the workforce, mothers in the workforce. Guess who over their lifetime is the most productive? Any ideas? Moms, people! The most productive employees, the most productive people are mothers. More than men, more than fathers, and more than women who do not have children. And it's not to bash those other subsegments. What I'm trying to say is, but the research does show when you have young children, you're less productive. That's a reality. Of course you are. You're trying to care for those young babies, and you don't necessarily have the support. But over the course of your lifetime, you're going to be more productive. And that's something you need to take home to you every single day and have that confidence.
So in the book, you talk about non-linear career paths. Can you walk us through an example of a non-linear career path? And you say that those work, not necessarily going up the corporate ladder, rising at a steady pace, but maybe, as Sheryl Sandberg called it, the corporate jungle gym or the corporate lattice. Can you describe what that is?
Sure. So we... So I interview 186 women, and I keep hearing the story after story after story, which is, I pushed, and then I realized I couldn't keep pushing, not necessarily because I wanted to be home with my babies, although many of them did, for a period of time, but what they really found was that all of that resistance in the workplace made them say, this is not worth it, I gotta do something else. So they downshifted, pause their careers and relaunch. So that was what was happening in the one-on-one interviews. So I was looking for data because, look, we're Silicon Valley. I'm kind of a geek. I want the real data. And I was shocked to discover that we have very little research on women's nonlinear careers that's contemporary. We have old research that says if you pause your career, you're screwed. Mm-hmm. But I heard in my 186 interviews that that was not true. So I was trying to understand, well, what's really going on? So I partnered with Erin St. Ange, who is a market researcher. She does work with Pepsi and Coca-Cola and everybody else, and she does all these surveys. And we also partnered with two professors who are experts in this field who had actually done some of the original research about women's nonlinear careers. We thought, okay, maybe we'll get 200, 250 women responding. Wouldn't that be great? 1,500 women, and I had to turn off the survey because we had deadlines. Everyone wanted their story told. So 1,500 women responded to our surveys, and these were women across the country. The caveat was we wanted women who were had children and women who had college degrees, because we wanted to understand that's the sweet spot of who should be at the top of leadership. What's going on, right? What's happening to these women? I had no idea what would be out there. We discovered that 72% of them had paused their careers at some point. That, for us, the pause was either they had downshifted to work part-time or reduced schedule, or they had completely left the paid workforce, not related to maternity leave, voluntarily. That was shocking to me. 72% of the women who were college-educated, in theory, most talented women in the country, were downshifting their careers for a period of time. The other thing that was fascinating is that only 11% of them had actually planned to pause. In other words, they went into their careers thinking that when they had kids, they would pause their careers. So this was not by choice for the vast majority of them. This was by, I have no other answer. This is the only solution I can figure out. But here's the long story. If you had stopped their careers at any of those points when they had left them, they'd be that classic dreaded opt-out mom. What do we have? Can anyone be honest and tell me what you really think about an opt-out mom? I'll tell you what I was thinking just as I was becoming one. They're lazy, they're quitters, they're entitled, they're not really committed, they can't hack it, they're not ambitious. My research shows that is completely false. 63% of the women who paused their careers view themselves as very ambitious. What they did was they relaunched. 89% of the women who paused relaunched their careers, and they would tell you to great success. They told us about their nonlinear paths. Many of them pivoted. We had sort of saw three paths. We saw one portion of them actually completely pivoted to new careers. I think you're a great role model of that. You've pivoted to a new phenomenal career. Others boomeranged, they kind of left their industry, most tech, for example, and then went back at a certain point. And the third group just sort of downshifted for a period of time and then reengaged. So same industry, same jobs, but just downshifted and went back. These women are rock stars. They're total trailblazers, and they're completely debunking the myth that you have to be all in all the time. You can have this nonlinear path and still get to the top.
Mm-hmm. For the new book that I'm publishing, Geek Girl Rising, which is coming out in May, I interviewed a number of women at technology companies in Silicon Valley and around the country. One of the women who I really just was in awe of is Julia Hartz, who's the CEO and co-founder of Eventbrite, the online ticketing company. And she said, she really makes a point of mentoring the young women at her company into leadership roles. And she tells them, listen, when you start having kids, it's going to be hard. There's nothing easy about having a baby and working. But if you need to go down to 80% or 60%, whatever it is, let's figure out a way to make it happen so you can continue with this company and stick with us. So let's talk a little bit about companies that are getting it right. Mm-hmm. And career, you talk about career paths. Mm-hmm. Like technology, we found, is a really great career path for parents, not just women, parents who want to have kids, because there is this flexibility and the ability to work remotely, which millennials want, right? So what are other examples of career paths and companies where you'd say, in your 20s, thinking about having kids, starting to have a family, this is the career you want to go in, this is the career you don't want to go in?
So we're in a lucky place to be, because what's happening in the technology industry is not quite happening around the rest of the country. And why is that? Because the average age in technology is 30. They're about to hit a huge baby boom. They don't want to lose you. They're scared to death. So they're now starting very quickly to make some significant changes. As you probably have heard, there's a lot of movement on maternity leave, extending maternity leave. Netflix has a year. Google's at 4 months. You know, Microsoft's around 4 months. That's phenomenal. They're also making huge movement on paternity leave. So what we need to do is get men to take the leave that they're being offered. And we're starting to see some movement on that. There's lots of longitudinal research around men who take paternity leave and what that does to the family. Two things happen. One, the women's careers stay much more, the women stay much more engaged in their careers. And two, the children end up being healthier and more successful academically. So when a father takes paternity leave, it benefits the wife and the children. So if you guys are thinking that, you tell that guy to get it, take it. The other thing that we're seeing that you, I think, we had talked about is we're seeing some really forward thinking around flexibility. We're seeing this remote work and the opportunity, the technology itself is allowing for that. We still have this pressure on FaceTime, but enlightened employers. In fact, you interviewed Jean at Medium, whom I also interviewed. Want to tell them about what she's going through and what you saw? I mean, Medium's rocking it as an example.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. I mean, Jean's Shu, I think that's her name, is a software engineer at Medium. And she has a new mom. I believe she has two children
she
now.
Does.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, she started a Slack channel for new moms, and she's working remotely and has flexibility because her company allows it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are a number of women who are in similar situations.
Yeah, so her boss said, well, this, of course I want you to be productive. Let me work it out with you. So we're seeing more and more, and her boss is a man, we're seeing more and more enlightened men who are married to their equals saying, wait a minute, we got to figure this out together. There's also a really fascinating trend that I think is happening right now in these return to work internships. Has anyone heard about these returnships? Yeah, they're really, cool, right? What's happening is really smart companies, PayPal, Coursera, oh, there's a whole bunch of them now in Silicon Valley that are starting to build these 12-week, sometimes 16-week internships for people, doesn't have to be women, who have been out of the workforce for more than 2 years. And they're actually doing these retraining, which, excuse me, 2 years need to get retrained? Don't even get me started on that conversation, but let's just say it's a good thing. They come in and then they actually get placed full-time in a great job. So I actually interviewed a number of women who had done this in financial services. So Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, a lot of them already have these programs and they've been going around for a number of years. I interviewed one woman, Andrea Chermayev, who was out for 15 years. She went through a 12-week program. I think it was J.P. Morgan. I'm sorry, Andrea. I'm going to get that wrong. And she's now been back for 2 years. Nobody knows she was gone for 15 years. She goes, nobody has any idea. The value is what I offer today. No one knows that she paused. So we are seeing some enlightenment. It's really exciting. We are trailblazers, but the next generation is going to truly benefit from this.
Exactly. There's another woman, Tina Lee, who started a nonprofit called Mother Coders in the technology space. She's trying to, there are going to be 1.6 million jobs in technology in 2020. And a million of those jobs will go unfilled unless we skill people up in technology. So Tina started a program. Actually, it's a physical program. A lot of these reboot programs are online. This is actually a physical program. You go in on Saturdays. They have childcare. You can bring your kids. And you learn the technical skills you need to go out and become a web designer, web developer, front-end developer. So this is something, you know, providing the support that women need with their kids to skill themselves back up into all these tech jobs that are going to be unfilled, which is insane.
Yeah.
Right?
So one of the things that, you know, I talked about our biases around, you know, opt-out moms, right? We have these preconceived ideas about them. Well, who does this sound like? They're entitled, they're lazy, they're job hoppers, millennials, right? That's what we call millennials, which just drives me crazy, right? Millennials are just going to rock it because millennials are saying, the men and the women are saying, I really value not just having a great job, but having a great life. And I want to figure this out. So employers are starting to realize that, and they're solving for motherhood, and it's solving for millennials, which is really great. We're loving seeing that.
Yeah. We like to say that Silicon Valley is growing up. That picture of Mark Zuckerberg changing his baby's diaper. Mm. You know, they're growing up, and they're trading in their ping pong tables and their kegerators for nursing rooms.
Yeah.
And paid leave, and we see it happening. It's a slow process, but the great thing is that there are women out there who are Joelle Emerson with Paradigm, yeah. and the whole Project Include group, which is going around and actually working with companies to say, with startups to say, listen, you have got to implement HR policies that value the whole person, not just the employee self. People have lives outside of work, and they're helping them put in policies and benefit programs that realize that we all have lives outside the office, and we have to live them. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit about foundation. So you talk about the importance of building a foundation in your career, and I have four kids, two of whom are going to be in the workforce relatively soon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm thinking after college, you know, it would be fun to travel the world and go do some crazy stuff. But what we talk about the importance of building your foundation, building your career, maybe getting your MBA in your 20s, so that when you do decide, if you decide to take a pause or pivot, you have that basis, that foundation to build on. Tell us more about that and what you found in your research.
Well, so you're absolutely right. The ability to pause your career, however that looks, be it leaving the paid workforce, be it downshifting for a few years, whatever that looks like, is absolutely predicated on the fact that you have a foundation professionally. That you actually have established things, you've actually had a number of successes under your belt, you've been able to build a network beyond just your employer, you've got some credibility, and you know how to nurture that network. The women who actually paused and relaunched successfully very easily were the ones who actually had maintained their network when they were unpaid. So I say, keep your career alive, whether you're in the paid workforce or not. That's what matters most. Because if you do that, these pauses don't have to kill you. One of the things that I thought was so fascinating and really, frankly, in some ways disturbing, many of the women our age had actually, very successful women, had paused their careers but hid it in their resumes. So their employers didn't know, or potential employers didn't know, that they had actually had these nonlinear paths. The good news is that's starting to change. Women are starting to say, I don't need to hide my pause. This is what I did. It was worth my time and effort. I learned these new things, and now I'm able to contribute even more to this job, this workplace, whatever. So we're seeing a real empowerment shift that's happening, which is so exciting. So if you do decide to downshift, don't hide it, because, hey, be out and proud.
Yeah. I did hear from a friend who told me, she said, Sam, I spent about 10 years out of the paid workforce. I was raising kids and volunteering at school, but I created a consultancy. Mm-hmm. So my consultancy was around volunteering, working with children. She said I wasn't paid for it, but I was still working. Mm-hmm. So she put that in her resume, which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah, she created her own LLC, right?
Her own little LLC, yeah, exactly. You know, so just showing employers, you know, I wasn't sitting around the house eating bonbons and getting massages.
When like
I
was every mother
raising.
Does that.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Let's talk a little about the word balance, because, you know, I write a lot for Huffington Post and Forbes about work-life integration, work-life fit. I always stay away from the word balance because it suggests that there is some perfect equilibrium between my work life and my home life. And, you know, as Viola Davis said so beautifully, it's just all a mess. You know, it's all a mess. So what term do you use to describe this work-life fit or this work-life mess? Or how do you describe it?
Well, I like to start with the optimal, which is work-life success, right? That's the dream.
Does anyone have it, though?
At any given day, do we? I believe balance is so flawed because that pits work and life against each other. Who are we if we're not what we're doing? Right? So if you're doing with your work, you're spending your days there, does that mean you're fighting against your life? No, that should never be. They should be integrated in some way, shape, or form. One of the things I learned in my research and interviewing the women is that they actually realize that at any given moment, it may be tipping to one side or tipping to the other, but over the course of 20, 30 years, they had integration and they had success. And that was kind of the long. So yes, is the answer, some women do. Mm-hmm. Because over the course of 30 years, which at this given moment, you may not feel it, you do have it. So right now, my kids are launched. The best phase of life, ladies, let me tell you. There's something to look forward to. And I'm telling you, I am all in with my work right now. There is not a thing I'm thinking about in terms of children. Well, except for I just want to make sure they're safe. But otherwise, they've launched. I'm not spending every moment of my life worrying about them. It's a gift. And it wasn't something I had for a long time when I had my children deep in my life and I was trying to manage my career and manage my kids. So I like to kind of give that end of life look, which isn't an end of life, it's sort of a start of life, to say, you'll get there and it's going to look great and you can re-engage in whatever you want and it's going to be liberating and free. And so yeah, that is work-life success to me.
Let's talk about men and fathers, because you did interview a number of men, and I thought it was really interesting how you said that the men that you surveyed or you talked to were the ones who were staying home, who were taking a pause from their careers to stay home with kids. They said that they felt like they were not respected. Mm-hmm. They felt that they just bad. It was like all negative feelings. Tell me about these stories and these men.
Well, so if you are a man in our society, you are valued for two things: as a provider. We have very strict gender norms for men, more frankly than we do for women. You're valued by being a provider, and you're valued by being all in with your work. Right? So if you debunk that, if you deconstruct that, and you actually say, no, I'm going to actually be the one who stays home with the kids, you're now being a caregiver. And that is, as we know, not something we value in society. And so you're debunking what we value, and you're also debunking gender norms. So the men I spoke to felt really under siege. Here's the problem. We're seeing a huge rise in stay-at-home dads. And people kept telling me, oh, that's fantastic. And I say, that's no disrespect to the stay-at-home dads. God bless them. That tells me there's something wrong with the workplace. That tells me that we're not able as couples to integrate our work and our family. That tells me we're losing great talent and something's wrong with that. So Anne-Marie Slaughter wrote in her book, Unfinished Business, that she went to Fortune's Most Powerful Women conference. These are, you know, the creme de la creme. And she's in this room, there's 100 women or so, and she asks, you know, how many are mothers? So the vast majority raise their hands. How many have stay-at-home husbands? The vast majority raise their hands. So the senior executives at these companies may be women, but they are women, and they may have children, these women, but they typically have a spouse who has downshifted his career and is a stay-at-home spouse. What does that say? It says to get to the top, you have to be an ideal worker. Something is wrong with that, because the reality is, in our work life now, it's not 1950s anymore. We need two people working full-time. So something's wrong if you're being rewarded to be that, and we got to change that fast.
Yeah, so I've seen in my research that Silicon Valley is actually at the forefront of making these changes in the workplace. It's still a very slow process. What can we do as individuals, not on a policy level, but individual levels, if we know we're facing this and we need, maybe not to pause, but we need to take some time to for our mental health, we need to take time for our physical health. What can we do as individuals to ask for what we need?
So here was a really fascinating thing that came through in both my interviews and the research. The women who had truly thrived in life were the women who truly valued themselves. And I know it sounds so hard. Oh, confidence, da-da-da. You know, good God, we all wish we had that, right? The women who understood their value and said, employer, I want to work with you to solve your solution. Right now, I need to downshift to 80 hours, you know, 80% time. But I'm only going to do that for 2 years because I just want to get my kids settled. And then I'm back in. When they were clear about their needs and objectives, and I've been a great provider to, you know, producer for you, I know that I can add value. When they were very clear about what they had to offer, they got what they wanted. And if they didn't get what they wanted, they said, thank you very much, employer, and they went somewhere else and created a new relationship or started something else. It was that absolute confidence that they could construct their reality that I thought so inspiring. And it's hard to believe, but honestly, when you're walking your truth, that whole cliche of the earth rises to meet you was true in my research again and again and again.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was interesting what Condoleezza Rice was saying about find something that you're passionate about, because when you're working in an area, feel that you're really loving your work, you're more likely to stick around, right?
So this was the really interesting thing with the research. Of the 27% or 28% who never paused their careers, right? Why didn't you pause was the question. The number one reason is they loved what they did. They found such great deep meaning in what they did. Why would they ever want to pause? The other second reason they didn't pause, they had flexibility in the workplace. Their employer said to them, mm-hmm. Hey, I want to work with you. I want to help you be successful. I'm going to support you in doing this. They had two things. Work worked and their life worked for them. That's what we all want.
Yeah. Well, Glassdoor does this recent annual survey of what the top employers and what employees are looking for in their companies. And college graduates, the number one thing they're looking for is remote work and flexible work situations, mm-hmm. followed by compensation, followed by career advancement opportunities, but the flexibility to be able to work from wherever. I mean, we're living in a 24/7 society where everyone's on their phones all the time. Like, you know, the idea of FaceTime has kind of gone away.
It's true.
Right?
So Ernst & Young just did a study, and they asked millennials around the world, what do you value? And that was exactly what they valued. More than pay, They valued work-life integration, work-life balance. They wanted flexibility of time. They wanted control of their time. The other thing that was really surprising, millennial men were more likely than millennial women to report that they wanted work-life balance, that they would be willing to take a pay cut or change jobs. That was really surprising. The other thing that was really fascinating was that in the last three years, millennial fathers, 71% of them had changed jobs to get better work-life balance. So the men are changing jobs, but they're not telling their employers, I'm doing this because your office place sucks. I'm going to find a better job. They're not communicating that, but they're secretly doing that. So,
So I think we have about 10 minutes left, and we'd like to open up the discussion to the audience. If you have any questions, comments, stories you want to share about your messy work life. Does someone have over here?
Come on. There's got to be questions. We'd love to hear from you.
Hi. I think I may be a millennial. I'm on the cusp.
We're all millennials at heart.
Yeah. high tech, fast-paced company I work for in security. And I am a mom of an 18-month-old.
Yay, congrats.
Little one. So downshifting sounds like a great idea. How do you mentally prepare for that when you are very ambitious? And you don't, that one, that work side of you doesn't want to slow down. Yeah. But obviously you're torn, which I have not read torn, but
awesome.
I can
it's
imagine.
Awesome.
Torn. We're all
so
torn.
Good. It's so good.
The angst, yeah.
I felt that definition.
Yeah.
How do you mentally prepare for that when you are torn and you are ambitious and you want to go for it?
Yeah.
But
well,
you also want to be a mom.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a conversation you need to have, not just with yourself, but I think you need to have it with your employer, with your partner, and figure out how it's what you want it to look like. And also realize that it's not going to be forever. So wrap your head around the fact that this is a period of time in your life where you might be going down to 80% time or part-time. Make sure it works with your company. Make sure it works with your family situation. And then mentally, I think it's just embracing, you know, your values. As Lizanne says so beautifully in her book, like, figure out what matters to you at this point in your life. And, you know, it might be different next year. It might be different in 10 years. But what matters to you now, and how can you prioritize that in your life at this point? And you'll make it happen, because what you value is going to stand out. It's going to resonate with you.
Yeah, I would also add money matters. So really get smart about your finances and figure out what you can do to integrate this pause if this is something you really seriously want to do. Because I didn't plan for the $1.5 million it would cost me to put my three kids through college. Pre-tax, $1.5 million.
Dear God.
Right. So if you've got kids right now and you want them to actually graduate from college without debt, which is the gift I'm hoping to give my children, you better plan for that. So, you know, I'm not at all saying this is la-la land. Be really smart about your pause and be serious. The other thing is, remember, you're going to have a career for the rest of your life. The whole notion, I said this before in an earlier thing, when do we say the word working dad? The fact that we actually say the word working mother implies that there's something else that mothers could be doing. No, mothers work. So you're going to work the rest of your life. You may not always be in the paid workforce, but you're going to have a career the rest of your life, just like you're going to be the mother the rest of your life. So get clear on what you want and when your priorities are, when you need to be focusing on whatever the key is to focus on.
Makes sense. And remember, it's a marathon, not a sprint.
I love that one.
Pace yourself.
Yeah.
Really.
Thank you for that question.
Yeah.
Hey.
So I had two thoughts. One is around just the scope. You guys seem to be concentrating on the younger years. So I've got three teenagers, and I'm also hosting an exchange student, so have four teenagers I'm managing. And really, it has never really stopped. So this notion of being an ideal employee, I don't even get it anymore. So, but then it makes me wonder, like, why I'm using a definition of success that cannot apply to me. Where I'm wanting to be successful in this way that, you know, yes, I've been working the whole time. I probably cut back for a while and I'm now back full time, have been for a few years. But there are certain seasons and days when I need to spend a fair amount of mental energy figuring out what summer's going to be like for the kids, how we're going to deal with carpools, all of this stuff. That this is now, you know, 19 years after my first pregnancy. So it goes on for a long time. And then I also didn't hear any mention of elder care and other types of burden or work that we want to do to make life good.
Mm-hmm. So I'd love to thank you for asking that really important question. One of the things that I found so distressing was that you're a mother forever also, and a daughter forever. So many women I interviewed, actually, well, I shouldn't say so many, a number of women I interviewed never paused their careers when their children were young, but were forced to pause when their kids were in high school and they were then also taking care of their parents. So we're hitting that. A lot of our generation is now hitting that point. My mother's very ill right now, and I have no kids at home, but guess what I have? I have a mom who's quite sick, and I'm spending a lot of time with her, and it's a privilege to do that. It's also challenging, right? So look, I think the underlying question, the one that breaks my heart that we haven't changed, that doesn't seem to be changing, is why we so vilify caregiving. No matter what we're caring for, why do we vilify in our country caregiving? Why do we spend all of our time focusing on work as though that's the ultimate agenda? And it's not about a rich life where we actually have meaning. One of the women I quote is a nurse who's a palliative care nurse who helps people die. And she said, every single man she's helped die, the number one thing he says is, I regret not spending more time with my children. Every single man. That's heartbreaking to me. So it breaks my heart that we have a country that doesn't value it. So all we can do as individuals is model it for ourselves, get really clear on what we want, and live our truth. And it's not easy, but I think that's the only way we can live it.
And also, you talked about, you know, success and how we define success. And, you know, originally my first book was titled I'm No Superwoman, because I had a breakdown. I the story of my first book was that I was working for a Silicon Valley startup, and I had a baby at home, and I got home from work, and we were about to go public, and it was like 24/7, weekends, you were on call all the time. And I got home one night, it was like 9 o'clock or after, and my husband and the baby are sitting in the high chair at the kitchen table, and my husband looked at me and he said, well, what are we having for dinner? And I literally almost left the house and divorced him. It was like, I was so upset. And I took a box of Cheerios. I called my box of Cheerios mom. I took a box of Cheerios, I slammed it on the table in profane language and told them to make their own dinner. And it was at that point that I realized I can't do it all. I can't be, I was a crappy mother, I was a crappy wife, I was a crappy employee. Everything I was doing was crappy. I was not doing well at anything. And it was the first time in my life that my boss actually said to me, you know, she was doing my performance review, and she's like, what's going on? Are you not happy? And I'm like, no, I'm depressed. I hate my life, you know? And it was painful, because I had been on this trajectory, like college and grad school, and go out there and you do it all. You can do it all, you know, bring home the bacon and fry it up in the pan. And I was like, and I felt like a complete failure. And I had to take a step back and say, you know what this is. And that was my first child. I have three more. So I got four kids. So it never ends. So again, it's like, how do we define success? I've changed my definition of success many, many times over the years. And it has not always been making a lot of money, having the position, the power, the title. That has not been it for me for many, many years. And that's, I have had to accept that. That's who I am. And my values right now, my priorities are my family. I love my work. I love writing. But put it in perspective. What success means to you.
But I also, yes, and doesn't it bum you out that we have to give, that the guy doesn't make in the goddamn dinner? I'm not disrespecting.
I know, no, right? I would have divorced him. I was ready to, like, walk out of the house,
but
I'm telling you.
The point is, we are...
A lot of marriage therapy.
My dream is that we don't have to pause. I wrote this book wishing we don't. And the reality is many, many, many of us end up having this kind of situation. So how do you navigate it given that reality? I would love it if we didn't have to have this conversation and we could have our definition of success. We do have more women leaders who have partners who are working, who have children that are thriving. That actually will be great. And men, male leaders who have partners that are working, et cetera. We're not there yet. And so I think it is one of the things we can do is call it out. Where is that unconscious bias? What are we doing? We have a lot of unconscious bias around caregiving and around motherhood in particular. Let's call it out and recognize it in ourselves and recognize it in our coworkers and call it out and say, yeah, no, she's not actually slinking out at 4 o'clock because she's not productive. She's going to her kid's soccer game. She's going to come on and be on the email from 8 to midnight. So give her a goddamn break, right? We need to start owning that.
Or just because she's 28 years old and is working doesn't mean she's going to leave in the next year or two have a baby
flight
and
risk.
Drop out,
right? Flight risk, right?
So you could go ahead, promote her. She's not necessarily on the mommy track because she's 28 years old. Yeah. Don't penalize her
exactly
for that. So.
Yeah.
So this is a very practical question. So for those of us who've got, you know, the two young children, two professional working executives, you know, for that segment of the population in your research, could you give us maybe like three or four high-level takeaways of the best ways to kind of structure your day in your life? Like, what have been the success stories in terms of how much you sleep, how many nannies you have, how many housekeepers? No, seriously, like the real dirty story of like the behind the scenes of what makes it work.
Yeah, that's a great, great question.
I have some answers, but I want
Go ahead.
So you're a unicorn. God bless you.
No, not me. For everybody out there.
Yeah, they're unicorns.
What makes it work?
To learn about the best way to structure their life.
Here's the truth. The women who have equal marriages, where they're both contributing and both have high-level careers, they're kind of unicorns. It's a myth. What happens typically is the woman's career takes secondary precedent. And this was true in all the research that I had. The women ended up having to give up a little bit in some way, shape, or form and actually privileging their partner's career. And they're not doing it because they're not ambitious. They're doing it because their husbands typically are making significantly more than they are, because even though they might be in the same industry, they might be in the same job even, the husband gets paid more. It's just scandalous. So let's start with that unicorn reality and let's debunk that. In terms of how you do it, God bless you. I think it's really hard. I think it takes, I was really lucky. I had a partner who deeply believed in equality. And he really thought, you know, he's about fairness. And so if I did the dishes, he cooked the meal. If I did the laundry, he folded it. It was just a beautiful thing. I know how lucky I am and how rare that is. But I think that starts there, having a partner who can really help you.
Yeah. And a couple other things to add to that, I think, is just real practical advice is that you need to ask for what you need.
Oh, that's a great one.
And I think women have a really hard time asking for, whether it's money, promotion, a day off, help from their partner. I know I did. I felt guilty asking my husband to do whatever around the house, even though we were both working full time. So step out of it and to get out of it and ask for what you need at home and at work. The other thing I noticed in my research was getting enough sleep, taking care of yourself. I mean, Arianna Huffington writes about it in her book, her new book, Sleep and Thrive, and taking care of yourself. And being productive in the morning, so getting up early, going for a run, getting things done in the morning. Don't schedule your meetings. You know, give yourself time in the afternoon for downtime. Do the things that are going to require like brain power first thing in the morning. So just some practical tips of successful women who've made it work.
And also the other one that keeps coming back to me is that the women who really rocked it were women who, they didn't co-opt what their husband was doing. So they didn't go in and try and say, oh, well, it's not quite right. You're planning Joni's birthday party. Well, you forgot to get the elephant, you know, or whatever it is, right? They actually said, fine, I let go. You're in charge. It was the letting go. That's the hard part, right? Because So that's the one thing I would. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to make this about us changing ourselves, right? God damn it. Let's change the friggin' system.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Hey there. I think it's so cool that you guys have been able to write books based on things that you're both interested in and incorporating your own stories. And I was just wondering if you could speak about your research process and your writing process.
My first book was an anthology. So the stories are, I edited 47 stories from different women, which was work, but it was a lot of fun interviewing women, hearing their stories. The book that I'm publishing in May, Geek Girl Rising, is I'm co-authoring it. So it's about women in technology, women in Silicon Valley and the startup world and what makes them tick. And it's really rewriting the narrative around Silicon Valley to show that it's not just a man's world, that there are women who are doing incredible things, who are innovating, starting tech companies, and really supporting each other in a sisterhood way. Co-authoring a book is very interesting. I'm not sure if anyone's ever, it's like having a partner, a co-founder in a company. So our process, it took about 4 years for us to do. We can talk about your book, but 4 years of, we did probably 200, almost 300 interviews with women. We didn't do a survey, but a lot of the interviews were one-on-one, on the phone, in person. And we really wanted to get inside Silicon Valley. So we went to a lot of the tech companies in the Valley, you know, in person to see what was really going on with women in tech. Four-year process, we, researched it, found a publisher about a little over a year ago, and it takes, you know, from traditional publishing, takes about a year start to end when you give them the manuscript to the time that the book actually comes out. So it was last December, so it's going to be a little over a year until it comes out. But co-authoring is a challenge. You know, it's working. It's like being married. You really have to know and love and be willing to forgive and work things out with your partner. So. Do you want to talk about your process?
We had 5 minutes. I had a book proposal. I got a publisher. I knew exactly what I wanted to write, and I had 6 months to write it. I had done some of the research already, and then I did. I couldn't afford to be pausing forever to write the book because it's, you know, you're not bringing in income when you're writing a book. So I slotted a very clear amount of time so I could do it, and that's what worked for me. I didn't have anybody else but my own demons and my own multiple personalities to fight with, so which may be harder. So, I don't know. Go ahead. Okay. Last question.
Hi, thank you for spending time with us. First of all, I've read Torn. Thank you so much for pulling that together. If this was already covered because I came in late, tell me to go make a friend and find out from them. You talked a little bit about kind of setting boundaries, which I think works if you've worked at a company for a while and you've had that credibility and you've proven your value. If you had to step off the treadmill for a little bit to deal with smaller children or sick parents or what have you, and you're about to re-enter, in your research, have you seen any effective tactics for kind of setting yourself up for success day one in the interview process, seeing you're interviewing me because I'm valuable. These are some things I need you to consider from the get-go.
Well, the thing that I saw, again, I think I mentioned it earlier, is not apologizing for your pause, not apologizing for your choice to downshift. To be really clear, I needed to do this for a period of time. While I was out, I built these skills or I did these things. I was surprised to learn this about myself, et cetera. I'm now ready to re-engage and move forward. The other thing is, I've interviewed quite a few women who just kind of stopped trying. Oh, it's too hard, women can't re-enter, et cetera, and that is malarkey. You know, what was the thing that someone said earlier? It took 200 submissions to get The Alchemist published. He got rejected 199 times to get The Alchemist, Paulo Coelho, or however you pronounce his last name. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a world bestseller. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. So the point being, you got 199 rejections before you're going to get your first yes. Maybe, hopefully, not that many. But don't give up is really, frankly, what I would say.
And also what Lizanne said earlier was, you know, keep your toes wet, like keep your feet in the water.
Keep
your networks intact. Have coffee with your old boss. Keep in touch with people. Don't let that all dissolve.
Our good friend here, lovely woman, is telling us, he's even taking the phone away. Ah, she's gone.
Okay.
Okay. So we can we take one more? One more, and then we're going to be book signing. We'd love to answer any more questions upstairs and sign books.
Thank you. Just quickly, I wanted to go back to the idea of tactics and tools and whether your research discovered, you know, some winning strategies around, you know, making sure you pay your, if you're too powerful, you know, good careers going, maybe even if you have to go to 80 or 90%, pay your nanny enough so that she has health insurance, so that she's reliable. You know, those meal delivery services from time to time. Figure out that, yes, you can pay somebody to clean your house once a week so you don't have to do it or fight with your husband about it. And it actually pencils if you value being able to keep your career. Like, are there other... It seems that almost
you should
every
come
day.
Join us here because that
that's
is awesome.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, are there new cool tactics and tools?
Uber Eats.
Highly recommend it. Yeah, Uber Eats has been like a savior for me in the past couple of months. They just started delivering. But yeah, not feeling guilty. Like, I think the other thing that I found in my research is that we feel guilty, like, because we don't prepare a home cooked meal every night for our family. My husband's not doing it, you know. So, it's okay to outsource some of that. Whether if you enjoy cooking, great, do it. If you don't, it's okay to order out. Laundry. I mean, there's so many different services available. I can't think of anything you can't really outsource, except for mothering. But then you have, you know, great. You pay your nanny. You have a nanny who you love, who, you know, hopefully, who loves your children, and you do have to pay for that.
But I want to bring up something you said that I think is so important. Look, did everyone go to college? So you all spent a lot of money on your college degrees. I'm sure a number of you have actually gone to graduate school. So you've already probably, or you know, are thinking about that. So you spent a lot of money, all right. You've invested in your human capital. Keep investing in that human capital, whether you're in the paid workforce or not. Figure out how to keep a babysitter or, you know, join the YMCA. They have 3-hour slots where you can actually drop your kid off to babysit. Keep your skills alive. Stay up with your professional networks. If you're part of an association, if there's a, you know, stay involved with Watermark. Keep alive your career. Stay on top of things that are happening because your career is forever. and you've got to nurture it. It's your human capital.
And get over mommy guilt.
Yeah.
Or easier said than done.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.